Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. My name is Jay Moran. For the next hour, we're going to be talking about the Remembrance Conference coming up June 6th through the 8th at the Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. With us today, we have three guests. We're very pleased to tackle what's going to be a very deep issue here. With us, Allison Brashear, MD, the Vice President for Health Sciences at the University of Buffalo and the Dean of the Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. Thanks for joining us. Also with us, we have Dr. David Milling, Executive Director of the Office of Medical Education, Senior Associate Dean for Medical Education. Good morning to you, sir. And also Patricia Logan Green, Associate Professor and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the School of Social Work. Thanks for being with us. All right, we'll start with you, Dr. Brashear. I want to call you Dr. Brashear, Allison Brashear. Just the origin of this conference. This is year three, right? And it's done in conjunction with Michigan State University.
Exactly. So the dean of Michigan State, Aaron Sosa, and I were at a conference and of deans, and we heard the CEO of Northwell speak about what they had done about gun violence. And we had, the episode on May 14th, the terrible tragedy, and then the tragedy at East Lansing at Michigan State. And we decided that we needed to do something. That's specifically a quote. And so we decided to do an exchange, and we had Michigan State students come to Buffalo and participate in some of the events that surrounded the first anniversary of May 14th. And then we had a bigger program at Michigan State, and then this is our third program. It is built around gun violence as a public health issue. And it is built around educating students, faculty, and other healthcare providers about how they can have an impact on gun violence. And it's brought in many, many schools supported by the AAMC to really begin to have these important conversations. And so we're really pleased to have the event here in Buffalo.
So I guess if we could start off with this general question, then how can healthcare professionals, how can they impact and help out this issue that, you know, we can talk about mass shootings, we can talk about just gun violence overall here in the United States. As a matter of fact, I know in some of the information here that 1% of the shootings in the United States are considered mass shootings. The rest come from domestic violence and other issues as well. So what about that? What are we finding? What can healthcare professionals do to help with this issue?
Yep. So really, I think, Jay, the biggest part of this is beginning to really feel and understand what the trauma is surrounding gun violence. Not only the physical trauma, but as we think about healthcare professionals, the mental health trauma also associated with this. And this affects everyone. So we are at a point now where we really have to think about all of these issues in a team-based approach. And so this goes to everybody in the healthcare field, physicians, other providers, social workers, nurses, et cetera, and the community. And everyone in this interprofessional kind of team-based approach has to be able to come together and think about approaches that can help. I'm going to say that Patricia has spent a lot of her work thinking about the public health approach to gun violence. And so I know she'd be happy to kind of take it and talk to us a little bit more from an academic standpoint in terms of where we are on this issue.
Absolutely. And just as a starting point, I'll say that when I first got into this work, I was inspired by guidance from the American Academy of Pediatrics that recommended that every pediatrician ask about firearms in the home as part of their routine safety screening. Do you use seat belts? Do you use car seats? Are your poisons locked away? And do you have a firearm in the home? That actually ended up being a really controversial question.
Right.
And we can get into that a little bit, but I think that that is a really important, simply having those conversations is a really important point that health professionals have to intervene with this problem. Beyond that, though, the importance of the public health framing is, instead of thinking about firearm violence in the United States as a criminal justice problem where we, you know, arrest and incarcerate our way out of it, which I don't think anybody would say is working at
right,
the moment.
Right.
We start to think about it as a public health problem, partly because it does affect our health and the health of our entire country so much in ways that I think have only begun to be documented, but also in terms of framing it through the lens of prevention. And prevention means multiple things. You could think about what's called universal prevention, prevention that could be done for everyone in the entire country or a community. Secondary or targeted prevention, which is for those who may be at risk. In this case, individuals who own firearms and are in crisis, or individuals who, in other cases, for a variety of reasons, shouldn't necessarily have access to firearms, which doesn't mean I think nobody should have access to firearms, just that some individuals we need to be a little cautious about. And then what's called tertiary prevention, which is prevention after violence has occurred. And framing firearm violence in those terms gives us lots of ideas and techniques for what we can use to not only prevent incidents, but also address the impact.
What about the impact, from a medical school standpoint, what about the students? You go to become a doctor, you're on that long, long road to becoming a physician, and I mean, who knows, who's thinking about, oh, I'm going to probably have to be dealing with not just, maybe many patients who are victims of gun violence. There's all sorts of possibilities there. But what about that? Is that one of those eye-opening moments in med school for students?
Gee, that's such a great question. I mean, I think when students come to medical school, that's absolutely not the first thing that's on their mind.
Right.
And very, very quickly, you end up in these situations on your emergency medicine rotation or your trauma surgery rotation, where you're exposed to this in graphic detail without any real training or any real preparation for what you get to see. And I'll say that until relatively recently, we really didn't do a really good job of reflecting on and decompressing and having an opportunity to have conversations about what has just occurred to students that have experienced this. And so our students have brought this to us as well to say, oh, you know, this is clearly a problem. How are we addressing this? How can we best advocate for change? And they want to be a part of the solution. So yes, no preparation. Every medical student ends up being exposed to this in one way or the other. And there is a real and valid interest dealing with this and being part of the solutions. In many ways, medical students always help us drive things forward.
Hmm. I saw you nodding your head there.
I did. Our medical students have been really instrumental in developing and broadening this program. I would also say our residents. So UB has 830-some residents, and they get exposed. Our faculty, nurses, everybody kind of in that interdisciplinary healthcare profession gets exposed to these situations. And there has not been a lot of attention given to that. And those different groups would like to become more advocates for what Patricia laid out, you know, prevention as well as taking care of the individuals, the families and the victims, but also the healthcare providers who are involved in these circumstances.
I don't necessarily want to get into the who should have guns discussion, but when, you know, this Remembrance Conference is done in conjunction with Michigan State University. Obviously, people who have listened to the show know that we reflect frequently on May 14th, 2022, what happened at the Jefferson Avenue Tops. But I did just a little thumbnail research of the Michigan State University shooting. And the individual who took his own life, I believe, at the end of after the shootings occurred, was known to be firing guns out of his back door. I'm trying to frame this and keep this conversation an idea that we're looking for ideas of how we can try to educate the community, educate people when it comes to gun violence. But what about that? What about the idea that there are signs to tell us that maybe we should be on the lookout for this type of thing? What about that? How from a public health perspective, are those issues being approached? Because and you said this, Patricia, right off the bat, you know, we're not here to restrict people from having guns. And obviously, if you get into the Second Amendment, you know, we could sit here and have conversations and counter conversations for hours and hours and hours. But I'm just wondering, what is, I guess, the push, or how are you trying to frame it to keep it in that line that we're looking for solutions, not necessarily bans of guns or things along those lines?
And it's very tricky. And I recognize that those who have strong beliefs in gun rights struggle with this because it is difficult to balance those rights against the need to keep public safe. And there are a variety of tools out there that are at our disposal. The best one is just to talk to your loved ones that you're worried about.
Okay.
That's honestly going to be more effective than a doctor or a social worker addressing you. But I'm going to get to that in a second, too. So let's say that you have an aging parent, and that aging parent is maybe going through a tough time, maybe has some cognitive decline. Let's talk to dad or granddad about those firearms in his home. And let's talk about maybe there are some things that can be done about, you know, immediate 24/7 access to those firearms. If you have a young person in your life who seems to be going through a crisis or maybe is acting a little erratically, try talking to them. Now, some of these individuals are going to have more loved ones than others. And of course, some of them are going to have different types of relationships with those loved ones. And that's when the professionals can play a role. They can do this just as part of a regular screening, but also if they have done that screening and they know somebody has firearms in the home, then later on when a crisis happens, they've lost their job, they're going through a divorce, they know that there's been some sort of horrible event in that person's life, they can go back to the fact that they have those firearms and say, maybe this is a time to temporarily take those firearms out of your home. You can get them back later, but right. Maybe right now they can be stored somewhere else. In Erie County, the Erie County Suicide Prevention Coalition has put together a fantastic map of places where firearms can be temporarily stored. You can just do a quick search on the internet for that and come up with lots of places. I don't know if 100% of the areas that might be listening to this have such a map, but there are lots of communities that put that resource together. Now, if people are unwilling to part with their firearms, even temporarily, that's when we get into considerations like a method called extreme risk protection orders. In New York State, those can be filed by a healthcare professional. or a behavioral health care professional, such as a social worker. And that is a civil process that would be equivalent to a temporary firearm restraining order.
You know, it's interesting when you said that, that a healthcare professional can perhaps seek this type of order. So that, again, now we're looking at it from, again, back to the medical students, but all healthcare professionals. We talked earlier about the trauma that they experience, but now there is this other part that's both a responsibility and an opportunity, perhaps, to enter into it. What are the conversations like right now when it comes to that type of, that element or that end of this conversation?
So I think part of this program is about how to be an advocate, as the medical students want to advocate for some of the things that Patricia talked about, how to understand some of the way public policy is made. I think those are really important things. I would also pivot back to the role of the community. So, you know, the role of parents, for example, when you're sending your children off to go play. One of the most powerful stories I took away from lots of conversations was as a parent asking the person, my child wants to come play at your house. Do you have a gun?
Hmm.
And if so, is it locked? I said, my children are grown, but when they were quite young, I lived in a completely different community, but I did ask that question, and somebody did have a gun, not locked, and my child didn't go play.
Hmm. Simple enough.
Right. And so the role of the community, having an awareness of that guns are out there. Patricia has some great statistics, but they're ubiquitous. And so, you know, teenagers, young children, the elderly, having access to guns, and people not thinking ahead of what the situation might be, that where the individual would get a hold of a gun, whether they're 1 or 2 years old or 80 years old.
I think that that's such a good point. And Jay, you actually used two interesting words there when you said from the community of professionals, how do you approach this responsibility or opportunity? And I think we're struggling with that. And, you know, this is, we forever have had that responsibility when it comes to driving and how we consider someone's driver's license or psychiatric issues. I'm not sure that we have really taken on that responsibility when it comes to gun violence. However, it's an opportunity for us, and that's a part of this entire conference, for us to make sure that we continue to explore and communicate and widen the opportunity with the hope of making that more of a responsibility as we move on to figure this out.
I really want to thank you for bringing up driving, because I think there are some really important lessons to be learned about the two stories regarding motor vehicle deaths and firearm deaths. So listeners may know that in 2020, firearm deaths became the number one cause of death for kids.
Mm.
Wow.
And there's a very famous chart that compares the slow rise in firearm deaths for kids to the precipitous fall of motor vehicle deaths for kids. How that moment in 2020 when the two lines finally intercepted after decades of motor vehicle deaths being much higher. And this is a tale of public health failure and public health success.
Mm.
So if we think of all the things that have been done to address motor vehicle deaths among kids, so better cars, better car seats, better campaigns to use car seats, campaigns around keeping kids in the back seat with their seatbelts on, rumble strips, and then campaigns around social norms like Mothers Against Drunk Driving that made drunk driving very commonplace, took it from being commonplace to make it a real social taboo to drive drunk now.
Sure.
All of those things reduced motor vehicle deaths for kids by huge factors. In comparison, we as a country are not taking the public health steps that could be keeping kids safe from firearms. And in fact, some states are undoing some of the public health measures that could be keeping kids safe.
You said, I can picture that that chart, right? You have one going down, one going up. We know why car or motor vehicle deaths for children have gone down. But what about why are gun violence or gun-related deaths going up for children? Why? What do we understand about this?
There's no one answer to that question, and a lot of people would give different answers. Everything from, you know, constantly increased rates of firearm purchasing, such that there are more and more firearms in the country at all times, to some states seeing conversations like this as a threat to gun rights and taking the opportunity to, instead of enacting public health measures, to instead roll back restrictions on gun ownerships or concealed carries, such that there are just perhaps multiple firearms in any social setting. I think social norms around violence and acceptance of violence appear to be going in the wrong direction. Lately, we have increased acceptance of violence, especially in some sort of subcultures within the United States. There may be other factors too. However, we are simply seeing all of these things slowly accumulate to increase rates of deaths among kids.
So one of the things I think is to also talk about the fact that this was developed out of the mass shootings, but that one of the top, if not the top, cause of death by gun violence is suicide. Mm. And so I think, British, you have some statistics about the gun suicide rate is 980% higher in the U.S. than to similar countries, and that we own in the U.S. more than half of the half of the guns in the country, in the world, with less than 5% of the world's population. So not just are we talking about gun safety, but we're also talking about mental health, as David mentioned, and that suicide by guns is a significant problem.
I'll pick up on that, too. Thank you for bringing that up. One of the important things to know about firearms and suicide is that firearms are by far the most deadly means somebody could use to attempt suicide.
Again, I think I would just, again, circle back, Jay, to where this intersection between gun violence and mental health lives, right? Everything that we've spoken about here, there, that connection can't go unnoticed or not discussed. And so, you know, as we look at any one part of this, it certainly is a part of the conversation that we need to figure out better ways to proactively identify who needs help. And as and Patricia said a lot of this in terms of how can we best help them to de-escalate some of these situations that come before us. You know, I'm sure Patricia has her stats now that she can right. help us with to continue this part of the conversation. But really, she brought up this kind of mental health part of this as well. And we need to always continue to think about where that fits into this conversation.
I wanted to double check the statistic, and I'm always hesitant to say it because it feels like it must be wrong, that the average fatality rate for all other suicide methods combined is 8.5%. Mm. And for firearms, it's about 90%. Mm. And that is a shocking difference, which is why I never trust myself to say it, because it feels like it must be overstating the problem, but it's not. And I also think it's really important to acknowledge that for a very long time, suicide prevention campaigns were coming out of things like the CDC and other federal government operations were forbidden from talking about firearms. Mm. So we are coming, we are at a disadvantage in these conversations because they have been taboo for so long to acknowledge the important role of firearms in suicide.
We're going to take a time out on What's Next and come back and continue this conversation. As you can tell, it's a serious conversation, an important conversation. We're talking about the Remembrance Conference coming up June 6th through the 8th here in Buffalo at the Jacobs School of Medicine, taking action on the epidemic of firearm violence through public health. Take a time out, come back with more on What's Next. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
The headlines don't stop. The world keeps moving, and through it all, you need news and information you can trust. That's where we come in. WBFO is now Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. Same station, same trusted journalism, just with a new name. From Morning Edition to All Things Considered, from Group Chat to Friday Night Lights, from What's Next to the BBC, we bring you the stories and smart conversations that matter. No spin, no nonsense, just the perfect mix of news, information, and entertainment. Listen anytime on the BTPM Listen app or btpm.org.
Here, Here, live music in Buffalo, New York is your guide through the melodic pulse of the city. Get a VIP behind-the-scenes look at the broad collective of vibrant festivals, historic venues, and mind-blowing artists that take the main stage and make Buffalo, New York the music destination it is. Listen to Here, Here, hosted by Bentley on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. and Saturdays at 6:30 p.m. on 88.7 BTPM NPR.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Welcome back to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. With us this morning, Dr. David Milling, Executive Director of the Office of Medical Education at the University of Buffalo, Senior Associate Dean for Medical Education, Patricia Logan Green, Associate Professor and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the School of Social Work at UB, and also with us, Allison Brashear, MD, VP for Health Sciences at the University of Buffalo, and the Dean of the Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. We're talking about Remembrance Conference coming up on June 6th through the 8th. And there's a lot in here, Dr. Brashear. When it comes to that, let's just get into some of the basics. I know there's a different levels. There's some professional speaking. There's a community day. But let's go through what's happening throughout the weekend.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So we have Megan Rainey. She is the Dean of the Yale School of Public Health. She will kick us off on Friday, and she is the co-founder and senior advisor for the American Foundation for Firearm Injury Reduction in Medicine at the Aspen Institute. Then on Saturday, we have our own Robert Gore. We are so proud of Dr. Gore. He's a UB grad. He works in Kings County and Downstate Medical Center. And he's the director of Kings Against Violence Initiative, a youth violence prevention program. And he's not only been one of our alums that we've honored, but he's been a top 10 CNN hero in 2018. And then we have our own Zanetta Everhart. She is speaking. She's been incredibly involved in the planning of this conference. And then she will be speaking about being an advocate for stricter gun laws. And then we have our own Patricia Logan Green, who's sitting next to me. And Dr. Logan Green is an expert and the co-leader of the National Grand Challenge in Social Work to Prevent Gun Violence. So we have a great lineup. We have also a community day. And so that's in Saturday afternoon. And we are going to invite the community into the school. And we hope to have them participate in multiple activities, including workshops, as well as, I believe, the remembrance portion of the program. I'll let Dr. Milling fill you in on that.
So one of the things that we initiated for the second year of the conference, Jay, was when we were at Michigan State, we actually had a remembrance ceremony. And so although tailored towards 514 in many ways, it's also an opportunity for people to think about what they may want to remember just globally. And so very, very powerful event. And we're looking forward to sharing that with the community, on Saturday. It's cathartic in many ways, giving, you know, people the opportunity to actually physically participate in that. And I think you've heard me say several times, you know, the trauma from this never ends. And so whenever there's an opportunity to try and address this in any way, it's always helpful to look forward to and to be able to do that for individuals.
And also this, for the most part, the conference is for healthcare professionals, right? But the Community Day is a day that's open to the public. We want to see as many people there as possible.
That's correct. Saturday is a community day.
All right, very good. And we can talk about registration before the end of the program as well. We brought up that big topic that seems to be just growing and growing, and that's mental health. We can go through this through so many different ways, but when it comes to, you know, just the society in general, let's just take guns out of her just a little bit, but mental health. Simple, is it just me seeing it from the outside looking in that mental health issues are they seem to be like they're more prominent, or is this a reality? What do we have? Who wants to talk about that a little bit? Go ahead, Patricia, your hand was up first. Thank you.
This is an enormously complicated issue.
Of course.
We legitimately do have a youth mental health crisis. This is not limited to the United States. It cuts across many countries where youth are experiencing mental health symptoms more than ever before, and that is leading to things like increased suicidality. There are a lot of complicated reasons for that, not least our social media or our era of what my colleague calls polycrises. Lots of things going on. I always want to be very careful when I talk about mental health and firearm violence, though, because some people, including some legislators, like to scapegoat those with a mental illness for our firearm violence.
I've seen that, sure.
Problem, and that is patently false. If you were to solve our mental health problems in the United States, you would not significantly affect firearm violence. One of the key pieces of evidence for this is that if you look at our mental health diagnosis rates, mental illness diagnosis rates across the world, we are not significantly higher than any other nation. Where we differ is our firearm ownership and access. If mental health problems were to blame for the firearm violence problems that we have in our country, you would see much greater mental health problems here. And that's just not the case. It's simply not the truth. However, there are ways in which mental health and firearm violence are linked, suicide being one of those mm-hmm. big linkages. The other one is that we are neglecting to talk about how much the firearm violence problems that we have in our country are affecting the mental health of our population. So there's a lot of focus on death statistics, how many people have died, what type of deaths they were. Were they suicides? Were they homicides? Were they mass shootings? Were they unintentional deaths? Were they police intervention? All of those categories. But we neglect with each of those is two factors. First, a lot more people survive firearms shootings than die from their injuries. It's depending on the year, it's about half. And this is actually because doctors have had a lot of practice treating firearm injuries, and they've gotten much better.
Irony there, yeah.
And there are some other really great campaigns that I expect will be talked about, like Stop the Bleed, which is recognizing how many people are getting shot in public these days. We need to train civilians to know how to stop bleeding from that sort of injury. Um,
Well, you know, as you were speaking, I saw Dr. Brashear, your head was nodding, and I saw yours as well, Dr. Milling as well. What about what Patricia was saying there when it comes to that kind of maybe confluence of mental health and gun violence being together, but really needs to be looked at differently?
I think it's a big mistake to say that, as Patricia said, that gun violence is due to the mental health problem. I think we need to separate them, and we need to address gun violence as a separate public health issue, and then the connection is between suicide. But I think it would be a mistake to just say they're connected and, you know, this is all about mental health. That is absolutely wrong. Correct?
Yeah, I think Patricia said that very eloquently. You know, it really is important that we understand that there is a connection, but despite the fact that there is a connection, the issue of gun violence in and of itself can't be blamed on mental health alone.
Right.
And I think that you know, we have to, it's not a nuance, it's just two separate things, and we need to treat them as such. You know, Patricia started to talk about Stop the Bleed as one of the kind of community things that we have had to learn to do because of some of this. And we up at the university, as are many places, are beginning to train as many people as we can in the community to be able to have these skills, unfortunately, to react to any of these circumstances that can happen in any of our communities.
Right.
It's not only gun violence, but it's touched us all in all of our communities. Mm-hmm. And I think that was actually one of the things that we spoke about when Dr. Brashear and Dr. Soso had this initial idea to start this group, was that every time we do this, we reach out to more and more individuals and more medical schools and more, because nobody is now able, is not touched by
right.
this in whatever community.
So that was an excellent point, David. So we actually have support and a team coming from New Mexico. The New Mexico Medical School, under the dean there, has gotten a group together that have participated in the planning of the conference and are sending a team to attend the conference. We have participation from a school in California. So this is a conversation that has spread just from the Michigan State Dean and me as the Jacobs School Dean. It's really spread. We've got participation from Ohio State and others, and we have support from the AAMC, which represents 160 medical schools. They've been tremendously supportive. So this has grown every year about the importance of having these conversations, thinking about possible solutions, and really uncovering gun violence as a public health issue. And this time, we want to pivot that this is not about just mass shootings. It's about gun violence in general, where we brought in experts like Patricia and the others that I detailed.
And, of course, the School of Medicine is there to teach. But these conferences, it sounds like you're learning as you're going along. What are some of the takeaways that you've received over these first couple of years that maybe help you expand the conversation? What are some of the thoughts?
So when we began the very first conference 3 years ago, was mainly related to medical students.
Mm.
And it was closely tied to 514. In terms of just timing and proximity. As we've done more and more of this, you know, we've tried to give a little bit of space to make sure that this is not, that there's some chance to separate the events and giving each person their space. But as we have done that, with the conference, and we started out with students and brought in physicians in Michigan State, and had some really, we had some really profound conversations about when, for example, in the emergency room, where physicians are now, as Patricia said, for reasons that are not necessarily good, so much better at taking care of these individuals. But also because firearms are also now so much more deadly, to prepare for casualties and not have anyone come in because everybody is pronounced dead at the scene. So if you can imagine what that looks like in an emergency room, it kind of mobilizing everybody and not having folks actually be able to come in for you to work on them and to save lives. And then changing that, not just from physicians, but to this year, a wider scope as to the team, healthcare professionals, the community generally, social work, everyone who works to make sure that we're able to have solutions. So that's one of the lessons that we've learned as we have gone through this, that, you know, as much as we started this out with teams of students, we're now thinking about this as the larger healthcare team and the community, and how important that is to continue to think broadly, to have solutions at all levels of this. So I think that that's important.
That's really well said, David. The Jacobs School is downtown, and it's our goal to open up the Jacobs School for these important conversations across the teams, with the community. We want to really help transform the health of Western New York. And this is a healthcare crisis. And we felt that by beginning this conference, as Aaron Sosa and I did 3 years ago, expanding when we were in East Lansing last February, and then this year in June, that we can begin to have an impact on how we deal with this crisis in our community, and then take that impact more nationally to begin these conversations with other medical schools and other hospital systems across the country.
And Jay, you heard Dr. Brashear mention the AAMC. So just in terms of a little bit more context, that's the American Association of Medical Colleges, which is our umbrella organization that oversees all of our
160 medical schools.
So with them as a supporter of this initiative as well, the hope is certainly that we are able to spread this, not just between Michigan State and the Jacobs School, but more in a more national way, growing that every year.
It's called the Remembrance Conference. It's coming up June 6th through the 8th at the Jacobs School of Medicine. We're going to get into our final moments with our guests and talk about not only the conference, but gun violence and all the related issues as well. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
This is Jack Cruiser with The Scoreboard on BTPM NPR. Listen during Morning Edition and All Things Considered each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the latest on pro matchups and college rivalries, as well as standout local athletes from Western New York and Southern Ontario. Want more? Listen to a longer version of The Scoreboard at btpm.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love. Listen to Buffalo Toronto Public Media at the Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on BTPM NPR at 88.7 or from your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Welcome back. I'm Jay Moran here talking about the Remembrance Conference coming up at the Jacobs School of Medicine, June 6th through the 8th. We're down to our final 10 minutes or so. With us, the Dean of the Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences, Allison Brashear. Also, Dr. David Milling with us, Executive Director of the Office of Medical Education and Senior Associate Dean for Medical Education. And Patricia Logan Green, Associate Professor, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the School of Social Work. And Dr. Logan Green, I know we kind of went to break there as we're having a conversation about lessons learned as we're moving along, and it flashed for you a couple of thoughts that you thought were important for this conversation.
Well, there's a few things I wanted to say. One of them is that I think an important element of this conference is that it's about remembrance.
Mm-hmm.
It's about acknowledging the lives lost in the communities, both in New York State as well as Michigan, but also I think it's important to acknowledge the impact that this is having on all of us. The other piece of mental health, and I think this is only just beginning to be documented, is that when we're all scared about firearm violence that could occur at any moment, anywhere, that impacts us. So there was an American Psychological Association survey that found that 1/3 of American adults avoid going to certain events because they're afraid of mass shootings.
Wow.
I am begging somebody to do a study on the number of American parents who have taken their kids out of school because they are scared of school shootings. Anecdotally, that is a high number. If you go to any mommy group online or in person, this is something that gets talked about because I'm a parent of 4 small children. There is nothing to stop it from happening in my kid's school next. So the mental health impacts come not just from the members of our communities that have been lost, but also from the fear that our kids, our families, our communities could be next. So that's one of the reasons I appreciate this conference. But I'll also just say that from a researcher perspective, this field was intentionally stifled for a very long time. Some listeners may be familiar with something called the Dickey Amendment that was passed in 1996 that expressly prohibited any federal dollars being used to fund research for around firearm violence because it was perceived as espousing gun control. In 2018, the interpretation of that was loosened to allow for federal funding of some research projects so long as they did not explicitly advocate for restriction of firearm rights. And we have had a real boom in the number of researchers and those who are in training and students, partly because there is suddenly federal research dollars to be had. We all know the importance of that, but also because we see it. We recognize this as a growing problem that impacts the health of our and mental health of our country. However, I can't say that without acknowledging that all of this funding, not just for research, but for the very crucial community violence interruption programs, are under threat and or have actually been canceled. Because it is difficult to find public statistics, we don't know exactly how much of the dollars that have been used to prevent or address these problems have been canceled by the current administration, but it's large. There was 1 week when $1 billion of funding for programming around violence prevention and mental health problems were canceled just unilaterally in the same week. And it's unclear whether federal funding is going to be available in the next few years to understand and prevent these problems again.
I don't necessarily want to throw a match in a gunpowder keg here, right? But at the same time, I'm just curious, and I don't want to get into administrative or administration decisions and things along those lines, although you're welcome to come back and talk about it. But I'm just wondering about the idea that, you know, here is, we have three people right here, and people who are going to come to this conference who have concerns about exploring this issue of gun violence and trying to find ways to approach it, that there are decisions being made at a federal level that seemingly reflect a large portion of this country's attitudes when it comes to this. Is that, am I just imagining that, or is that something that you have a sense of yourself? I mean, again, I'm not necessarily talking about the, you know, somebody trying to lead the public, but maybe is following a portion of the public that just feels that this isn't a problem.
I don't think many Americans agree that firearm injuries and deaths or mental health problems are not things we should address. I think that is a very small viewpoint. People have differing opinions on the best way to do that, but I think if more Americans realized how many programs designed to help mental health problems in kids in our schools, community violence interruption programs, and violence interruption programs, I think if people realized how much has been cut in the past few months, more people would be angry.
So I think the point of our program is to have broad awareness of the public health crisis. And as David said so well, begin the conversation between not just medical students, but residents, faculty, nurses, the support staff that work in the emergency room, and come together to see, not only recognizing it, but come up with ideas to do a solution. And some of these ideas are quite simple, about, you know, the discussion in the pediatrician's office needing to be rote, make sure you do it every time, those type of ideas. And then some of them are much more broader and need to be more detailed and have funding, as Patricia discussed. But we can still focus on this problem here in Buffalo and bring together people that are great thought leaders on beginning to have a plan and some recommendations, and then grow that across the medical schools in the country. And that's what we plan to do.
This, Jay, I think to your point, this is really two prongs, right? I hear you when you say there's a large group of individuals who think that nothing to see here, right? But how I'd like to refocus that is what we are dealing with here when we talk about students and practitioners are people who are living this every day. So there is a lot to see here, right? And it changes the focus depending on the lens in which you're looking at things. And when you see how it affects people and their families who die or who do not die, who live through this and have to deal with the aftermath of these incidents, then you realize that, yes, this is something that we need to figure out a way to be better. And that's what we're trying to do with the conference, right? We're trying to look at this to figure out how can we move away from this situation that we have that can affect any of us at any time, and figure out how to change these numbers to move in the opposite direction as we did with motor vehicle deaths in young people, right? Instead of kind of the same old thing.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. That's a well-stated way to finish, actually, our program here. It is the Remembrance Conference coming up June 6th through the 8th at the Jacobs School of Medicine. The Community Engagement Day on June 7th, that is open to the public. The rest requires the registration of healthcare professionals. Most certainly welcome to come and explore these issues. I'm sure there are a lot of perspectives that could really add to this. Once again, our guests have been Patricia Logan Green, Dr. Green, the Associate Professor and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the School of Social Work at UB, Dr. David Milling, Executive Director of the Office of Medical Education and Senior Associate Dean for Medical Education, and Allison Brashear, MD, VP of Health Sciences at the University of Buffalo and the Dean of the Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. Thank you very much for bringing this conversation to us and touching on some important issues with us. Thank you very much for being with us. This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.